Members, I will now call the Post-Secondary Education and Lifelong Learning Subcommittee to order. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Mariano.
Here.
Vice Chair Pacencia.
Here.
Ranking Member Thompson.
Here.
Representative Alexander. Representative Andrade.
Here.
Representative Arrington.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Botana.
Here.
Representative Caruso.
Here.
Representative Fabricio.
Here.
Representative Fernandez-Barquin. Representative Gottlieb.
Here.
Representative Mello.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Morales.
Present.
Representative Persons-Malika.
Here.
Representative Salzman.
Here.
Representative Tant.
Here.
We have a quorum, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members, and by your presence, we have a quorum. First, we have up today PCS for House Bill 1423 by Representative Tuck. Representative Tuck, you are recognized to explain the PCS.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members. HB 1423 amends the eligibility requirements for participation in the Florida Post-Secondary Student Assistance Grant Program. Under the expanded eligibility requirements, students will be eligible for the grant program if they are either one, a full-time degree-seeking student accepted at a nonprofit virtual institution that is accredited by a member of the Council of Regional Accrediting Commissions and is created by the governors of several states. The institution must be established and continually maintain a location of operation in Florida and maintain a governing body or advisory board in Florida for at least 1 year. Or two, a full-time certificate-seeking student accepted at an aviation maintenance school which is located in Florida, certified by the Federal Aviation Administration, and licensed by the Commission for Independent Education. That is the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Members, are there any questions on the PCS? Seeing no questions, we will now move into public testimony. First, we have Julia Corona with Southeastern College. You are recognized. Thank you for coming today.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Julia Corona. I'm currently the Executive Director of Southeastern College. Prior to my new position of a couple months, I have been with the institution for 17 years, serving as the campus president and experiencing firsthand what our student struggles, right? What this grant means to our students. And I'm here today to really concerned that we're considering making the pot or what's available to students, making that smaller by adding what appears to me is to be one more institution to it. As of right now, there's about 20% of our students in our sector that are eligible for the funds that don't receive it. Our schools are Florida-based chartered schools. We've been in Florida as a school for over 33 years. We serve students in our community that are we're a minority-serving institution. We work with single moms, single dads, veterans. We usually, we help students that have not been successful in the community colleges really get the support that they need to get a career. A majority of our students are allied health students that have been in the front lines of fighting this COVID pandemic. And I can tell you that reducing this grant or reducing the availability of this grant by adding more people to it can make the difference of a student being able to stay in school or not stay in school. And our institutions are, Florida-based, Florida staff, Florida faculty, Florida students that stay in our community, serve in our communities, and are, taxpayers to Florida. So I think that this could hurt that as well, if we consider that. My other concern is that we are looking into accepting to this an institution that provides competency-based learning that isn't as the same quality as instructor-led training or traditional online learning. So that is a concern to me as well. In addition, the amount of students that don't receive the funds now, you know, to go back. And, you know, I can tell you, I've firsthand lived a student that this fund or this grant has made a difference with them staying in school, being able to afford to continue staying in school. And just the thought of not being able to offer them that is just, you know, disturbing to me, honestly. So that's my, I respectfully ask that you consider not amending the statute and leaving it as is.
Thank you for your testimony.
Any questions?
I don't see any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Today.
Next, we have Alan Mortham, Florida Association of Post-Secondary Schools and Colleges. Good afternoon. You are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. As you said, my name is Alan Mortham. I represent the Florida Association of Post-Secondary Schools and Colleges. Actually, Southeastern is one of our members, so I'm kind of glad that she got to go first. But from a general standpoint, we represent the proprietary schools here in Florida, which, for those of you that don't know, are the private post-secondary schools such as Full Sail University, Rasmussen College, Ultimate Medical Academy out of Hillsboro, Concord Career Institute. Almost all of these schools in as a whole will have some kind of presence in each of your districts. It's really vitally important that we really take a hard look at how we're dealing with these, you know, these PSAG funds, because it's such a small amount. The bill that was as originally drafted went to a little bit of a different area of PSAG, bigger fund. The one that we're talking about now in the PCS, this past year had $6.1 million in it. Just a few years ago, that fund had over $10 million that it was giving out on a regular basis. So it's already been declining the last several years. Just to give you a couple other quick facts, not to, you know, to hit some of the things that Ms. Corona already did, but there's 5,594 students from 2019-2020 that got these funds already. They are from 67 different campuses around the state. One of the things that she was talking about, and I really want to hammer it home, we have students that are getting less than $300 currently out of this fund. So if you don't increase the size of the appropriation, which I think all of us know currently is going to be very difficult from an appropriations process. If you add, you know, new eligible students, there's only one thing that you can do, and that is to reduce the amount of funding that each of the eligible students would get. Like I said, in some cases, you're talking about students that are getting less than $300. These students, you know, this is a need-based program, and if you look at, you know, just by the numbers in the report from the Department of Education, the vast majority of these students, and I think it's 60-some-odd percent, are minority students. You know, they're going to our schools because they have, you know, jobs that they're working on, you know, during the day, supporting families, you know, as she said, single moms, you know, people that are looking to start a new career, and they just can't go to the traditional colleges the way, you know, I did when I was, you know, 18 to 21 years old. You know, thankfully that worked for me, but it doesn't work for everyone. They depend on these funds, and I would just say again that I would call it problematic public policy when a system that's been in place since 1972, almost 50 years, and you have 67 campuses that are, for lack of a better word, playing by the rules that the statute lays out, And now you have a single school, well, I guess two now because you have the aviation as well. But you have a single school that wants to access funds that they would not be eligible for if not for this bill. So that's, you know, that's our members' concerns. I appreciate the time, Madam Chair. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you for your testimony. Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. What portion of the education that students sign up for is covered presently under FSAG?
You're recognized.
I didn't catch 100% of the question.
How much of the cost of an educational program is covered presently for a student under FSAG?
Okay,
you're recognized.
So, yes, ma'am, thank you. Sorry. Again, what I'm referencing is the Department of Education Office of Student Financial Assistance end of year report. It looks like the average is about $1,100. So depending on what type of program they're enrolled in, cosmetology, for example, is a less expensive course than nursing. So I can't give you an answer without having, you know, a specific course to talk about. But that's just generally speaking. It looks like it's about $1,120 or so.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. So with additional students who would become eligible for FSAG, the amount then for the students who presently get it would, in your estimation, not cover the cost, or would it? Or can you answer that depending on what the major is?
You're recognized.
Well, the cost from FSAG doesn't cover the entire cost anyway. The FSAG is accessed. There's a priority order of things that you have to access before you're eligible for these funds, like Pell. So you have to access all of those funds. This is almost like a fund of last resort. So it doesn't cover all the costs anyway. However, just anecdotally, I'm told that there are more than 5,000 students in the school that would become eligible under this bill. Not all of them would be eligible for FSAG, to be fair, but certainly a portion of them would. So the award would have to go down, or the amount that the legislature would appropriate would have to go up. And again, I don't think that that's probably a reality under the current circumstances.
Thank you. Representative Tant, did you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello. I have a quick question. I have two questions. One is about the Council of Regional Accrediting Commissions created by governors of several states. Who is on our commission here in Florida? That's the first question. And secondly, and part of that is that the governing body or advisory board of one of these groups has to be in Florida for at least a year before the institution students are eligible. So who are we looking at serving under paragraph B, and who is the accrediting body to do that work?
You're recognized.
Okay, I think I understand your question. So in Florida, the governing body is CIE. They are housed within the Department of Education. That's the Council for Independent Education. They are not the accreditor. They are the regulator. So it's a little bit different. The schools that are that fall under CIE's jurisdiction, many of them are accredited by various bodies. Some of them are not. So, you know, there is some variation there. As far as the paragraph you're talking about, and I want to make sure I...
Lines 44 to 46.
Yes, ma'am. That is, they are the accrediting body for this particular university. It is, you know, they are a good accreditor. That's not an issue. They are certified with the United States Department of Education. I don't think that there's anybody that would argue that it's not, that this isn't an accredited school, that this isn't, you know, a good school. It's just that this school accessing this particular pot of funds isn't necessarily appropriate.
Follow up.
You're recognized.
So then what is to prohibit somebody from coming in and setting up shop for a year and then doing this who hasn't been fully vetted? That's my question, is if this is a regulator and not an accreditor, how are we sure that the students are going to be taught?
You're recognized.
You would, at that point, you would be dependent upon an accreditor from outside of this jurisdiction. And again, that could be problematic. Mm-hmm. It could be problematic, absolutely. I'll leave it at that.
My last question.
You're recognized.
On page 3, looking at line 60, we're talking about the aviation students receiving an award of up to 110% of the clock hours. How much money is that? Do you know offhand?
You are recognized, but we also did have questions for the sponsor, and there were none, so just...
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I don't know. They're not a member school of ours. Again, they are like the other university. They are not housed in Florida. Their home base is in another state, and they're not members of ours. So I don't have, unfortunately, access to some of that data. But I think the same type of argument could be made.
Thank you. Representative Arrington, you recognize for a question?
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for the sponsor, but maybe you know. Do you know how many of the aviation maintenance schools we have in Florida? I know there's one in my district, but do you know how many that there are?
You're recognized, but I'm not sure that you're qualified to answer that.
I don't know the exact number. I could certainly get with CIE, and they have, you know, they have that data. I'm happy to provide it for you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions that relate to his testimony? Seeing none. Next, we have Kim Estep with Western Governors University.
Good afternoon, members. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of the bill. I'm here representing Western Governors University. I wanted to leave you with some remarks on, first of all, how Western Governors University is a very different college or university than any other universities currently in operation in the state of Florida. And second of all, a few points about how WGU's students are different from other college and university students across the state. First of all, WGU was founded in 1997 by 19 Western governors who got together to try to solve problems in their states. And their primary problem at that time was they did not have enough graduates in workforce-focused program to meet the needs of their state economy. So WGU was born of a public-private partnership that has been very successful and now spans all 50 states. They created a program that was competency-based because competency-based allows our adult students, most of whom come to us with significant college credit and work experience, to go through the program at their own pace and to finish more quickly. And by finishing more quickly, they also save a substantial amount of money. As a private nonprofit university, we are very low cost. We only charge on average $6,670 a year for enrollment in our programs, and we do not charge by the course. So students who can finish in 2 terms or 3 terms will finish at a substantially lower cost than someone who takes a longer time to complete. By being competency-based, each student completes the curriculum with the help of many faculty, so we are certainly not lacking in faculty. Every student gets a program mentor who calls them every week and works through every step of their program from the day they enroll until the day they graduate. In addition, we have course instructors who work with students on specific courses as they reach each course in their program. And because our students bring in significant expertise in many cases through 15, 20 years in the workforce, sometimes they can move through a course much more quickly. Sometimes it may take them longer for a course, but this competency-based education allows them the opportunity to move at their own pace so they are more likely to be successful, more likely to do so at a lower cost. WGU students in Florida are different. We currently have 7,000 students in the state of Florida who are enrolled at WGU. We have students in every county of the state of Florida. We also have 501 employees, most of those faculty, who live in the state of Florida. And so they live here, those students live here, they are taxpayers, 100% of them pay taxes in the state of Florida, they work in the state of Florida, and as with many local colleges, they will stay in Florida and complete their educations. Our degree programs only exist in four areas. We only do workforce-oriented programs. Nursing and healthcare is our largest college in the state of Florida. We also offer degrees in business, IT, and teaching. So we have a lot of second career teachers that come to us to get their teacher licenses or teachers who want to gain a master's degree with us. We have approximately 11,000 WGU alumni living in the state. So we saturate Florida already with our graduates. They are living and working in every community in this state. Approximately 66% of our students are women. These are typically older students. The average age of students in the state of Florida is 37. These are students who typically come to WGU because they can't access other higher education institutions. They have children at home. Many times they need to take a test at midnight because that's when their children are asleep. And they can sign up with a proctor and take a test at midnight with WGU. They can't do that anywhere else. They need the one-on-one assistance of a mentor and a teacher as they go through the program so that they can leverage the learning that they already have and complete as quickly as possible. They get that with WGU. Approximately two-thirds of our current students in Florida are considered underserved, meaning they either are low income, first generation, a student of color, or a rural student that lives in a community where there is not an existing baccalaureate institution. Eligibility for this fund would help our neediest students. Approximately 1,100 of our 7,000 students have a zero estimated family contribution on the FAFSA, meaning they would be eligible for Pell and their family makes a low enough income they would not expect to contribute any. So they would be the ones that would likely benefit from inclusion into this fund. We believe that they should have that opportunity. Again, every one of them is a Florida taxpayer and a Florida citizen. This would serve Florida's neediest students, and we believe that it would be in the best interest of the state in building a very well-educated workforce. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. All right. No questions?
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
Next, members, we will move into debate. Are there any members that wish to debate the PCS? All right, I'll just make a couple comments. The testimony that we heard today was focused on the amount of funds for this grant, but missing the point of what I believe to be Representative Tuck's bill, and that's helping students. This provides more access to these programs to more students, and this is a really student-focused bill. For example, if at one of those other institutions, the enrollment were to increase, the same problem would exist. So this is really about just helping expand access to our students that need it here in the state of Florida. Representative Tuck, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it's important to remember here that even though this is a non-traditional style of learning, these are Florida-based students and they have the exact same financial needs, and we need to offer the exact same financial assistance so that everybody can succeed. And with that, I close. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Tuck, having closed, Kirsten, please call the roll and announce the vote on PCS for House Bill 1423.
Representatives Alexander.
Yes.
Andrade.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Bell.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Caruso. Fabricio.
Yes.
Fernandez-Barkin.
Yes.
Gottlieb.
Yes.
Mello.
Yes.
Mooney.
Yes.
Morales.
Yes.
Persons-Malika. Placencia. Salzman.
Yes.
Tant.
Yes.
Thompson. Chair Mariano.
Yes.
15 yeas, 0 nays, Madam Chair.
By your vote, PCS for House Bill 1423 is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Next, we will take up House Bill 507 by Representative Rizzo. Representative Rizzo, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, wherever you may be, Ranking Member Thompson, and members and staff. House Bill 507 stands to do a lot of things. Most importantly, the salient points of the bill are: it requires certain students to take a specified assessment relating to civic literacy. Two, it would require certain post-secondary students to complete a civic literacy course and pass a specified assessment to demonstrate competency in civic literacy. And finally, it would require school districts to provide an ACT or an SAT to all grade 11 students during a school day. Those are the salient points of the bill.
Thank you. You have one amendment. Would you like to explain the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment would remove line 323 and insert Schools and Department of Juvenile Justice Education Programs. That is the amendment.
Thank you. All those, so are there any questions on the amendment? No questions, any debate? All those in favor of the adoption amendment signify by saying yay.
Yay.
All opposed, nay. Members, by your vote, the amendment is adopted. We are back on the bill as amended. Are there any questions on the bill as amended? Seeing none, we'll move into public testimony. We have Mr. Robert Holliday.
You know, my glasses will fog up if I don't take them off with this mask. Thank you, Chair Mariano, and thank you to your very capable assistant, Elena, for putting up with me as I urged you to get this on the agenda. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., I am going to speak to the Senate Government Oversight Committee in opposition to SB 490, which would make a Texas holiday, Juneteenth, an official Florida paid state holiday, marking the end of slavery in this state. A lot of us will tell the committee tomorrow morning that this is historically wrong. Juneteenth, June 19th, has nothing to do with Florida. Our Emancipation Day is May the 20th. The fact that the legislature is on the verge of doing something historically wrong in one bill is ample reason why it needs to pass this bill, HB 507, and its Senate companion.
And please keep your comments to the content of this bill.
Which would require a post-secondary student in Florida to meet the civic literacy requirement, whose components, as enunciated by the legislature, are government and history, by actually learning something by taking coursework. The fact that there are apparently many members of the public who don't know our basic history should be sobering and should make all of us realize that merely taking the Florida civic literacy test by itself, 100 multiple choice questions, half of which are online at the U.S. Immigration Services website, won't help you learn anything. The Department of Education realizes this, which is why they have supported this bill language for the last 2 years. I hope that you do too.
Thank you for your
testimony. Thank you all very much.
Next, we will have Sarah Clements with ACT, Inc. Oh, I'm sorry. Could you come back for a question? Thank you, Member Thompson. You are recognized.
How are you, Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm doing well, and it's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
My question is, do you see Juneteenth and May 20th as mutually exclusive? Can we celebrate both, in other words?
You are recognized.
I think you can. It's just which one you decide to have as a paid state holiday. As you all know, the language in Florida statutes now recognizes Juneteenth without making it a state holiday, and it's been sitting there, and it's my understanding that there are amendments going on right now but would still make Juneteenth. But the official Emancipation Day in Florida is May the 20th. I mean, Juneteenth just didn't happen in Florida. I mean, I realize Texas has done just a great job selling this, but it's not Florida.
You're recognized, and let's just, I mean, he brought it up.
I know, I'm sorry. I knew that, I was afraid that would happen. It's my fault. But I thought I ought to bring it up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with regard to civics education, you and I've had numerous discussions, and I agree with you that it's very important. And as a part of civics education, could we promote, we have many paid holidays. Could we promote both a paid holiday for Juneteenth as well as May 20th?
Absolutely.
You're recognized.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Next, we'll have Sarah Clements with ACT, Inc. Ms. Clements, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair and committee members, for allowing me to be here to speak on behalf of ACT. As you all know, there are many assessments that students take throughout their K-12 career. These are important for the adults in the system because they provide us really valuable data on how kids are doing and help us to make decisions on behalf of those students. Most assessments that kids will take throughout their K-12 career do not provide a real tangible benefit to those kids, and the college readiness assessments like the ACT and SAT are the exception to that rule. So these assessments provide students the ability to access post-secondary education as well as to help pay for that education through scholarships and financial aid like Bright Futures. What this bill does is it really helps reduce the equity gap between kids with resources and kids without resources. ACT already provides fee waivers to students. They can get up to four throughout their high school career. And about one-fifth of all ACT test takers nationally use that fee waiver. But when students have to sign up for a test on their own, get to that site on the weekends, it's not always at their neighborhood school that they go to. There's a lot of extra logistical burdens that are placed on that student. It may not seem like a lot, but actually 3 out of 10 kids who qualify for those fee waivers don't end up going to the test on that day. So there are some issues there, and having the ability for kids to take this assessment on a regular school day at the school they go to 5 days a week just really helps reduce that equity gap for students. Also, one thing you may not know, the ACT and SAT provide a valuable second measure to help demonstrate students' readiness for high school graduation. So if you do not pass the 10th grade reading FSA, which is a graduation requirement, you can earn a concordance score on either the ACT or SAT, and many students use that pathway for graduation. So we think this is a great bill. We urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, we'll have Alexis Kalitayed from Department of Education. I totally butchered her name, probably. And she waves in support. All right. Now we will move into debate. Members, is there any debate on the bill? Ranking Member Thompson, you are recognized in debate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think because we now are requiring an assessment related to civics, that this is a good bill, because many people will not know and will not understand that after the end of the Civil War, when President Abraham Lincoln sent Union soldiers throughout the South to read the Emancipation Proclamation, that those soldiers came to Florida on May 20th, and read the proclamation on the steps of the Knot House. People need to know that. That is factual. They also need to know that the last of the slaves to get this news were in Galveston, Texas, and they received that news on June 19th, 1865, and June 19th has been contracted and is known as Juneteenth. I don't see those two things in conflict, and the civics assessment would highlight both of those. So I think given that we are requiring an assessment that should include a comprehensive view of history, that this is a good bill, and I'll be supporting it today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, seeing no other debate, Representative Rizzo, you are recognized to close on the bill.
Well, thank you very much. And in speaking with so many of you, and I apologize, as I'm sure the rest of the members understand, we've been busy with committee and lobbying or working our bills and speaking on behalf of what we believe in. And so there's a number of people that sit before me that I didn't have a chance to speak with in person, but we will continue those conversations. But be that as it may, I'd like to say that it is heartwarming to see and truly inspiring to know that so many of my colleagues appreciate education, see the value in something like this, that this goes beyond any racial or political divide that there may be, or whatever it is that we have that we debate about. We can all agree that these bills, such as this, are good for kids in Florida and will truly open the doors of opportunity for everyone. So thank you very much, and I thank you for your positive support and hope you vote yes.
Representative Rizzo, having closed, Kirsten, please call the roll on House Bill 507 and announce the vote.
Representatives Alexander.
Yes.
Andrade.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Bell.
Yes.
Botana.
Yes.
Caruso. Fabricio.
Yes.
Fernandez-Barquin.
Yes.
Gottlieb. Mello.
Yes.
Mooney.
Yes.
Morales.
Yes.
Persons-Malika. Placencia. Salzman.
A handsome yes.
Tant.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Chair Mariano.
Yes.
14 yays, 0 nays, Madam Chair.
By your vote, show House Bill 507 is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Chair.
Last but not least, we'll have House Bill 281 by Representative Duggan and Representative Zika. Representative Duggan, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dual enrollment is the enrollment of an eligible secondary student or home education student in a post-secondary course creditable toward both a high school diploma and a career certificate or an associate or baccalaureate degree. To be eligible for dual enrollment, a student must be enrolled in grades 6 through 12 in a Florida public school or in a Florida private school that is in compliance with the requirements specified in law. A growing body of research suggests that participation in dual enrollment leads to improved academic outcomes, especially for students from low-income backgrounds and first-generation college students. Research suggests that participation in dual enrollment leads to better grades in high school, increased enrollment in college following high school, higher rates of persistence in college, greater credit accumulation, and increased rates of credential attainment. With that background, the bill affects the following changes. It reduces confusion in the identification of students who are under DCF custody who are eligible for the dual enrollment tuition and fee exemption, specifically those students who enroll at a post-secondary institution prior to the age of 18. In other words, to clarify that they would be eligible. Beginning in the fall 2021 term, the program that would be created, the scholarship program created by this bill, will reimburse eligible post-secondary institutions for tuition and related instructional material costs for dual enrollment courses taken by private school or home education program secondary students during the fall or spring terms. Beginning in the 2022 summer term, the program reimburses institutions for tuition and related instructional material costs for dual enrollment courses taken by public school, private school, or home education program secondary students during the summer term. It also renames the collegiate high school program the early college program and clarifies that you do not have to be a junior or senior to participate in that, and is currently the case. It clarifies they just must be high school students enrolled full-time at an eligible post-secondary institution for 30 credit hours. Finally, it also creates a bonus for state university, a bonus program for state university system employees that can be in addition to an existing program that exists, but be utilized for recruitment and retention purposes. That is the bill. I also want to clarify one thing, because I know I suspect several of you have been contacted by members of the public. This bill has nothing to do with Bright Futures. Unfortunately, the companion to this is Senate Bill 52, run by Senator Ray Rodriguez, former Majority Leader Rodriguez. His bill nor my bill do anything to do with Bright Futures. It merely creates a dual enrollment scholarship program. Unfortunately, there is another Senate bill, I think it's Senate Bill 86, that Legis is showing as a compare to this bill. So I think it's creating confusion in members of the public that somehow this bill has anything to do with changing anything about Bright Futures. It does not, nor would I support any effort in that regard. So that is the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Andrade for a question.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair Duggan, for the bill presentation. I appreciate the explanation, but I just want to make sure, are you 100% sure that this bill has nothing to do with Bright Futures?
You are recognized?
Yes, I am.
All right. Any other questions, members? Seeing none, we will move into public testimony. First, we have Jennifer Hatmeyer from Cape Coral. She is a proponent of the bill. Next is Alexis LaRoe, Step Up for Students, waiving in support. James Herzog, Florida Association of Academic Non-Public Schools, waiving in support. And Michael Barrett from Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops, also waiving in support. All right, debate. Do we have any debate members? Seeing no debate, Representative Duggan, you are recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to acknowledge the hard work of Representative Zika, who has championed this issue and this bill over the last two sessions. I'm happy to and proud to have him as the prime co-sponsor on this effort. Thank you for your support.
Representative Duggan, having closed, Kirsten, please call the roll and announce the vote on House Bill 281.
Representatives Alexander.
Yes.
Andrade.
Yes.
Arrington.
Yes.
Bell.
Yes.
Botena.
Yes.
Caruso. Fabricio.
Yes.
Fernandez Barquin.
Yes.
Gottlieb. Mello.
Yes.
Mooney.
Yes.
Morales.
Yes.
Persons Malika.
Yes.
Placencia. Salzman.
Yes.
Tant.
Yes.
Thompson. Chair Mariano.
Yes.
15 yeas, 0 nays, Madam Chair.
By your vote, shall House Bill 281 is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Members, that concludes today's agenda. Seeing no other business before the subcommittee, Representative Bell moves we rise. Without objection, meeting adjourned.